Hey everybody, my name is Alex and this is Lunchbox Radio. Now, before we get started, I wanted to encourage you to go listen to my episode all about Tales of Wedding Rings from last week. That show fascinates me in like a morbid way. I've talked about this a bunch of times on the show and I talked about this in the beginning of that episode, but I get this strange feeling, like need to watch just the worst thing possible sometimes, and it brings me to either like seriously the worst thing possible or something that's interesting. It's like bad in an interesting way, and every once in a while you get like a weird mix of both. Actually, that's usually what it is, and that's really what Tales of Wedding Rings is, because that show got was pushed a lot by Crunchyroll. Like, they put it on the main stage at the last Anime NYC. And the whole thing's just wild. So definitely go check that episode out on the feed. It's the one immediately before this. In whatever podcast app you use to listen to me weekly, hopefully. But on that note, I want to jump into what we're talking about today. We're keeping this whole, like, currently watch anime thing rolling with a little show from this year that's still currently running. Like, it's in the middle of its run, technically, but I think there's enough of it to talk about, so I want to talk about it. Called Delicious in Dungeon.
Anime considered. Lunchbox Radio.
Now, one of the reasons you go to anime conventions in this day and age is not just to spend entirely too much money on merch that you don't ever buy any other time of year, like an old taku like me. You also go to see panels, but then you go to see premieres, because more and more the draw for those conventions is that there will be shows or new seasons of shows that will be premiered at those conventions. And oftentimes, like, the last season of High Card premiered at Anime NYC with much of the creative cast behind making that show. So you got to, like, just ask the director of High... pick the director of High Card brain if you wanted to, which was fantastic. We also got a fun little like half deck of playing cards that were like all the cards from the show, which was just a fun dumb little thing. But which I have sitting on my coffee table actually. But the point is that those conventions give you kind of they remove the kind of industry barrier just a little bit for the fandom, and you get to go see things before other people see them. And so, generally speaking, these showing rooms, like, the first thing they do is they're like, hey, don't record this, dumbass. We're watching. We will kick you out. And, like, people have been at, I've been in screenings at these conventions where people have been asked straight up to leave. but that's because the stuff, largely when you're seeing this stuff, it's not in its complete form. Sometimes you're maybe only seeing even part of an episode. You're not seeing the full episode. Oftentimes, you're almost never seeing the opening credits or the ending credits of the show, because that stuff just, it hasn't been, like, cut together yet. So they're like, here's this hot new thing. Put it on a giant screen and hope it goes well. And it really does have that vibe. And they like warn you, like, hey, you're not seeing the opening or the ending, because, like, that stuff hasn't been super nailed down yet. And here it is. Go ahead. And last Anime NYC, one of those shows was Delicious in Dungeon. And or Dungeon Meshi, which is a much-loved manga. And, like, people love that manga. And it was finally getting an adaptation. But the really interesting thing about it was, is that Trigger was on the hook as the animator. And the reason why that was interesting is because Trigger likes, generally speaking, Trigger likes to do projects, or has done in the past projects that are much less constrained. Like, if you look at, even if you look at the most like this thing, which has a bunch of production connections with this thing, the most like this thing that Trigger had done previously, which is actually Cyberpunk Edgerunners, they had a lot of say and of control when, so, and this is a urban legend, I'm not entirely sure how true this is, but I've heard this, when they were done with the story for Edgerunners, they handed it over to the team at CD Projekt Red, and CD Projekt Red is like, what the fuck, take Rebecca out of this, remove this lowly character, and Trigger was like, no, no. And hindsight, Trigger knew what they were doing there. They were putting in a character that would become a fan, an absolute fan favorite. But people, like, the like gut reaction of the oversight of CD Projekt Red is like, this is fucked. This is like the nightmare anime shit that we don't want to stand for. And Trigger is like, you asked for us, you got us. And that story illustrates kind of why something like Delicious in Dungeon is such an odd fit for Trigger. But the other thing that oftentimes, and then I'll get into my thoughts on the show. The other thing that oftentimes, I'm going to have I give us a synopsis. But the other thing that often, and then I'll do my thing. But the other thing that oftentimes people forget about animation studios, because we're all fans and we all love all these shows and we're all here for the art and the artistry of it, but it is an industry. Some of the best anime properties from the past, like, decade are shows that are about the anime industry. You look at shows like Keep Your Hands Off Eizouken. You look at shows like Shirobako. Those shows, and Shirobako especially, are kind of examinations of the industry and of, like, what the deal is there. Shirobako has a great scene, and I've alluded to it a bunch of times, where they break down the cost of a single episode of animation. But the more interesting thing to me is the second season. Before the second season of Shirobako happens, they're having the conversation about a property they want to go after, and everybody's really excited about it. They're like, we could really do this well. But then you, in the Shirobako movie, you see that, like, the studio, this, I forget the name of the studio in that show, has kind of broken apart and people have gone to work in other places. And you see that, like, every once in a while, as a creative person, you get a kind of perfect blend, a kind of beautiful, everything, all the pieces fall into the right place, and you have a job that you love. And that might last for a really long time. But you also have moments where you're just trying to pay the bills, where you're just trying to put food on the table, where you're just trying to, like, pay rent. And so I think what caught people off guard and what puzzled people about this particular choice by Studio Trigger to, like, do something where they were, was so clearly an adaptation of something else in such a strong way, is that, like, they made a choice that seemed like we're paying the bills. And now before I go any further, I want to hand it over to I for a summary of the story, since she does a much better job at this than I do. I, take it away.
Dungeon Meshi, also known as Delicious in Dungeon, is an adaptation of the manga series written and illustrated by Ryoko Kui. The story revolves around a unique blend of fantasy, adventure, and cooking. The plot is set in a fantastical world where dungeons are filled with monsters and treasure. The protagonist, Lyos, is part of an adventuring party that ventures into a dungeon to explore and seek riches. However, things take a turn for the worse when one of their members, Lyos' sister, is eaten by a dragon. The party is defeated and forced to retreat. Left with limited resources and driven by the desire to save Lyos' sister, who is still alive inside the dragon, the party comes up with a novel survival strategy, cooking and eating the monsters of the dungeon. This decision is bolstered by the introduction of Marcille, a sensible and slightly skeptical elf mage, and Chilchuk, a prudent and experienced halfling lockpicker. The show combines elements of survival, cooking, and fantasy adventure. Each chapter typically features a new dish made from a monster. These dishes range from basic grilled meat to more elaborate meals, often including real cooking methods and fantastical ingredients found within the dungeon. This culinary aspect is not only for sustenance, but also serves as a unique way of understanding and interacting with the dungeon's ecosystem. The story is not just about cooking. It also delves into the lore of the dungeon, the backgrounds of the characters, and the larger world they inhabit. The characters grow and develop through their unusual culinary adventures, and their journey to save Lyos' sister is filled with both dangerous and humorous moments.
So now that we've talked, now that I've taken us through a summary of the story of Dungeon Meshi, I want to talk about why this wasn't just a Trigger paying the bills thing, and why, even if it was, even if it comes out that like Trigger was like, we have a permanent staff and we had to write paychecks. A, that's fine, but B, they didn't do anything any less than they would have. You know, the show is absolutely drop-dead gorgeous. It's conceptualized really well. The character designs, although from what I understand, similar to the manga character designs, are beautiful and work really well. And I think the thing that is rooted in, and this is something that is hard to understand if you've never been to Japan or you're not really super familiar with, like, just, if you're, let's say, a little bit newer in the anime game, when people think of, like, otakus and otaku culture and nerdiness, they think primarily of Japanese anime. They think of, if I tell you I'm an otaku in America, they say, yeah, like, I know what that is. You like the cartoons from Japan. If I say that in Japan, they pause and they ask an extra question. They say, about what? And, like, the stage is fully open there. It could be about trains. It could be about airplanes. It could be about the military. It could be about all these different things. It doesn't have to be anime. My point here is a thing that people forget is that, like, the, like, same kind of nerd fan culture that can exist here can exist everywhere else. It's just we're seeing it funneled through a whole different culture. There are people in India who are deeply obsessed with trains. There are people in India who are deeply obsessed with anime. There are people in Japan who are so, like, uncomfortably obsessed with 1950s rockabilly, American rockabilly culture. It's insane. And what I'm trying to say here is people and groups of people can be more than one thing. And in the same way that, like, one fandom eventually informs another fandom, that is also true of, that is true everywhere. So the, like, baseline that makes up how we understand RPG video games will always be the tabletop RPG. And I'm playing a tabletop RPG kind of week to week. We skipped last week because there was a bunch of technical bullshit. But we're playing week to week. And it's really interesting to see all the, like, stuff that you usually see in a video game, but, like, you're controlling it very specifically, and you built this character, and RPG role-playing is really, like, it's, like, in a theater of the mind type thing, mostly. But that stuff has informed anime in one way or another for decades. All of the isekai stuff you see is ostensibly borrowing from video games that are borrowing from tabletop role-playing games. That are borrowing basically from Dungeons and Dragons. And so that fan culture has always been there in a deep way for a really long time. And it's just one thing that, like, Trigger specifically as a studio really understands is it really understands the core of these kinds of, like, nerdy fandoms and what's interesting in those hobbies, and it can bring them to bear in really unique and thoughtful ways. And what this show does with the kind of, like, D&D structure plus its kind of cooking show vibe plus its kind of light Yashke vibe is it creates something that's fun, funny, interesting, but also has the mechanics to be really serious when it needs to be. And this show at moments can be really, really, really deadly serious. So from this point on, I'm going to say spoiler alert for Dungeon Meshi, Delicious in Dungeon, because I'm going to talk about really specific plot points here. Now, we're only halfway, at the time I'm releasing this, you've probably gotten the 13th episode, meaning that we're only halfway through the story. But the reason why I want to talk about this first half here is because it feels like a full story. It feels like you could have stopped here. And it's really interesting that they're just not stopping. the show just decided, like, oh no, this was the halfway point. Or the story has decided that. At the beginning of the show, Lyos, the main character's sister, is just eaten by a dragon. But what's really interesting is the show doesn't dwell on that an awful lot. Like, it's to the point where sometimes it feels like they don't really care that his sister was eaten by a dragon. And then the show eventually gives you the reasons why they don't care. But what the show's kind of main crux is that they are cooking and eating monsters from the dungeon to survive. And the show does a really good job of setting up a kind of, like, the background mechanics of this world just enough so you understand why they're doing what they're doing, and you understand the struggles that adventurers, so, like, people explore the dungeons or try to conquer the dungeons in this show, fail to often. To the point where they even mentioned specifically the reason we fucked up with the red dragon the first time was because we were hungry. And they're giving you little hints along the way of, like, this is why people don't do well and don't often make it that deep down in the dungeon. It's because they've run out of food. And the reason why they run out of food is because food is heavy, so you have to carry it with you. And you meet this character. So you have this part. You have this party of three initially. You have a party with Lyos, who's like your typical knight adventurer, blonde hair, like Thor's whole thing. You have Kilchuk. You have Chilchuk, who is I don't remember what race he is, but he's like shorter, big ears, and he's their like trap specialist. Like, he'll figure out booby traps and make sure nobody dies. And then you have Marcel, who's this. I don't think you classify her as a high elf, but she's an elf, and she's the party's like magic user. And Lyle, you pretty quickly realize, has basically read this monster Bible, this like monsterpedia for dungeons, cover to cover, constantly. He's basically a walking index of monsters. Like, he sees one and he like lists out like what the deal is. But in this monster encyclopedia, there's also all these little things like, and this monster tastes like this when it's cooked like this. And the thing I love about this show's like humor is immediately the show is like, yeah, but no, but like that stuff is in there, but who the fuck is ever using it? Like, who knows what depraved lunatic found this out and then died immediately after? Like, everybody else is like, no, not eating monsters. But Lyle becomes like deeply obsessed with like figuring out, like, do these monsters taste like this? Does this taste like chicken? Like, what's up? And then they make it, like, I want to say, like, a quarter way down, and are in, like, a rest. They're in, like, a commonly agreed upon, like, rest area that was, like, no, where there's no monsters, and people can just kind of regroup and, like, catch their breath and, like, heal or whatever. And they make a point of, like, showing that they're experienced by seeing these, like, rookie adventurers running away from this, like, hilarious little mushroom man. And Marcel just bops the mushroom man on the head. And her response is like, oh, I say to those guys, she's like, they really should stop letting novice adventurers down here. Like, that wasn't that dangerous, but some of the other shit, nightmare. Just nightmare. So you get the idea that, like, they know what they're doing. They've been doing this for a while. Like, this is their profession kind of thing. And they get to, like, the rest area. And I think they bring the mushroom thing with them. They bring, like, the mushroom thing with them. And they encounter a character named Senchi, who's a dwarf. And Senchi lives in this dungeon. You find out later that Senchi just lives in this dungeon. And I feel like, how the hell does he do it? He's eating the monsters. So Senchi is all like chef extraordinaire. He's the one who understands most of this stuff. But eventually you get to things like the episode pretty early on, where it's, I forget what episode it is, but I could probably find it. Where it's all about living armor. And the surprise there is living armor is like basically like a shellfish scenario. But Senchi never knew that. So it's all of these great takes and all of these interesting things about this world fed through this very specific lens. And This is going to sound super weird. But do you remember a little show from a bunch of years back, from a couple years back at this point, not a bunch of years, but a couple, called Interspecies Reviewers? If you remember it, it's probably not because you've seen it, because it's not super easy to watch, because it It was an ecchi anime that, and I've talked about before on this show. I actually talked about it with Slate. If you know Slate from MCS anime, anything. I brought him on, I think I brought him on like the first or second time to specifically talk about this wild ass thing that happened. Basically, this show, like if Delicious in Dungeon is like the success of this like typical D&D adventure style fantasy anime, plus this unique angle that has slightly nothing to do with that. If this is a success story, then I would consider something like Interspecies Reviewed to be the like bump in the road. And there's a bunch of reasons why it's not a one-to-one. The main one being that Interspecies Reviewed was a ecchi manga, and Delicious in Dungeon very much isn't. It's like a feel-good, nice, like, with a side of adventure and slight drama thing. But what they're both doing is pretty similar, because the idea behind Interspecies Reviewers is you almost never see them adventure. see them do their, like, adventures or go on, like, quests or any of that shit. You understand it to exist. What you see them doing is the shit they do in their off time, which is they're just going to brothels. Just endlessly. And the reason why that show got like nuked off the side of the planet was because I forget the studio that did this, but like the manga was like a very specific tone. It was like riding the ecchi line, essentially. Like it was not safe for school, but it was not like you would be full on reading porn, which, you know, people do on trains in Japan, but it's fine. The anime adaptation of it took it, but just like, nope, we're not screwing around here. We are full on making porn, but we're not going to tell anybody that's what we're doing. Probably because in the animators' heads, they were like, you give this to us as a blueprint, we're going to make porn. Like, what did you think was going to happen? And, like, so, if you don't know, if you look up Interspecies Reviewers, and you look for the article from that time, you'll see that it was on Funimation. It was on major streaming services. All of which dropped it after, I think, like, They got to episode 3. And by episode 3, when they are, I'm not kidding you. Eating grilled meat off of a fire lady's crotch. Just bare crotch. Just whole time. Where, like, the meats have, like, her coochie print burnt into them. That was what, like, I remember watching that being like, what is happening? How is this allowed to be on this service? I guess, all right, let's go. Because, and this has kind of nothing to do with this, but it's interesting, so I'm gonna leave it in. But and this isn't a problem with Dungeon Meshi, and this is actually less of a problem if any of this kind of stuff came up in this show, because it's on Netflix, and Netflix has a pretty good reputation in this regard, in that, like, if you make something, they'll put it on. Like, they mostly because of Dave Chappelle, unfortunately, have kind of dug themselves this hole of, like, you make a thing, and they said yes, they're putting it up there. And there was a little bit of that in the air at the time, but by and large, it was, and it still is really only High Dive. That's like High Dive is like out. High Dive is out here, and it's like we don't care what you make. Like it, art is art. Art is art. We will promote art. That's if you're wondering, one of the reasons why everybody's pissed off about the Go Anime, about the buy anime split off from Funimation. That's from Right Stuff after Right Stuff got bought and incorporated in Crunchyroll. That's why. Because Right Stuff was full on like, of course we carry porn. Porn is art too. Fuck all the way off. And the thing about, so let's bring it back to Dungeon Meshi. Dungeon Meshi is kind of the same formula. It's the kind of fantasy formula you're familiar with, but focusing on something that, yes, has to do with the fantasy formula. Yes, totally existed in all of those fantasy stories you probably already are already aware of, but isn't typically focused on. And so it lets the, like, traditional fantasy elements, the traditional RPG storyline, take a back seat. And so the storyline of Lios, Marcel, Chilchuck, and Senchi going to get Lios' sister, going to save Lios' sister from Fallon, from the Red Dragon, because she got eaten by Red Dragon, is a totally different, it takes a major backseat to like a kind of recipe of the week plus monster of the week kind of vibe that, yes, when they get to the Red Dragon does refine into a more serious storyline. But until then, it's like, I wonder if we could even eat living armor. Like, that's fucking they're like, and everybody's like, you, Lios, you're a sociopath. That shit's metal, y'all. And you're like, yeah, but what if we could? And it turns out to be kind of like mollusks. But it's a really interesting show. It's really well crafted. It's really well aware of itself. So, kind of Trigger's debut thing was Inferno Cop, but one of Trigger's like bigger, well-known early things was Kill la Kill. And Kill la Kill, so much of Kill la Kill revolves around fan service. It's very hard to separate fan service from Kill la Kill. You could probably do it, but you twist yourself into pretzels. But also one of their big things was Little Witch Academia. And so with those like two sides, you see a show that is like tons of fan service, tons of action, tons of like, and like there was a joke back when Kill la Kill came out, that the anime that's going to save anime, and then eventually everybody was like, yeah, but be careful. Like, you learn the kind of person somebody is based on why they recommend you watch Kill la Kill. And Little Witch Academia, on the other end, was much quieter. It still is fun, but it was less. I don't think I've talked about it on this show, but I should. It was less, like, bombastic, but it was still fun. And so, you had this demonstration in those two shows that the thing that Trigger does really well is that it's got a like 500 miles an hour, all the lights are green, full triggerness of it all vibe that it can produce very easily. But it can also control that vibe and control that look and feel and control all the things about it to produce something very different. Because if you look at something like, so if you hold up brand new animal next to Cyberpunk Edge Runner. You can believe that the same studio made that thing, made those things. You can also believe that the same studio that made those two shows made Kill la Kill. And you, like, trace that all the way back, and you're like, oh, lots of those people were involved in Gurren Lagann? Surprise, the fucking prize. But then you look at something like Little West Academia, and you're like, you can kind of get from Little West Academia, you can kind of hop, skip, and jump that to Brand New Animal. But you really can't to Cyberpunk Edgerunners. And you can't really get there, like, go across to Kill la Kill. But you can get from Little West Academia to Delicious in Dungeon. And what's interesting here is one of the... And I've said this before, I actually pay for ChatGPT because I found it super interesting. I still find it super interesting. But I use it to, like, collate and look up production details for shows because that stuff is all over the place on the web, and I would love to just, like, I just made a custom GPT, I call it Fujoshi Sensei, to just funnel all that stuff into one place. So if I say, hey, what are the production details of, like, say, Tales of Wedding Rings, like I did for last week's episode, it will tell me, like, the studio, what that studio's made, and I can go into that and be like, what about this director? What else have they done? And it'll give me all that stuff. And what I found, and I was slightly surprised at, is the person who did storyboards for episodes 7 and 8 of Cyberpunk Edgerunners, which I think is the last two episodes, was the director for Delicious in Dungeon. That is, like, a super tone shift. It is, like, night and day shit. But the fact that, like, a studio can produce both is really important. Because Trigger is unique in this, but it is also not unique in this. In that, like, Trigger has a house style that people recognize. And like I said at the very beginning of the episode, this doesn't fit this house style. Lots of people coming out of that premiere, me included a little, were like, yeah, but why does Trigger need to be doing this? Like, it's adorable and it's fun, but, like, A1 could do this. You know, anybody could do this. But the more you get into it, the more you see this kind of vibe that is Trigger firing on all cylinders in a different way. So, and the best way I can kind of liken it is Trigger can make a show like Cyberpunk Edgerunners that completely captures the anime audience for like a month. When that show came out, it was so clear to me and every other content person make any kind of anime content across the internet, like, drop everything. I don't care what you thought you were talking about. You're talking about this. Because this is the only thing that will do any fucking numbers for the next month or two, basically. And none of us were wrong. Because that show was so captured the anime world for the time it came out. But the really interesting thing about Delicious in Dungeon is people are talking about it, but it's not like the zealous, like, oh my god, have you seen it? It's like, no, it's a really nice time. And people bring it up. So I listen to, like, most people, like, most anime fans do, like, probably most of you listening to me right now do. I listen to Otaku's Anonymous. And Nick from Nick, the Weep Commander, one of the two hosts, he just kind of brought it up in passing when they were talking about the next season slate of shows. He's like, yeah, I'm watching Delicious in the Dungeon right now, and it's great and fantastic. But, like, they don't bring it up because it's not this, like, hype beast, like, super hype, insanely awesome thing all the time. And it's really interesting because Solo Leveling is coming out. I've been watching Solo Leveling week to week, and I'm probably going to talk about it next week. Because it's the thing that Solo Leveling is doing, it is doing like an empty version of like the super hyped mainstream show. And if you look at that show, like on the like number side, I bet you would be disappointed. I bet Crunchyroll a little doesn't know what to do with it, because it has this hollowness to it. And the reason why trigger shows don't have that hollowness is because they have enough experience and they keep up their experience by doing things like the last big trigger show before this was Edgerunners. And Edgerunners is like what you think of as like a super hype, insanely awesome, grips you from the minute it starts and doesn't let go until it throws you to the ground at the end trigger show. It is trigger as fuck. The show they did before that, I think with Brand New Animal. I don't think there was anything in the middle there. Brand New Animal is like a mix of the vibes of Cyberpunk Edgerunner and the vibes of Dungeon Meshi. It has really calm, serene moments, but it also has super balls-to-the-wall action moments. And so much of the anime landscape is dominated by these like really hype show, by these really overhyped shows and these really mainstream, mostly from Shonen Jump properties, that I think that I know they'll never go away. I know they will always be there, because there'll always be an audience of 14 to 16 year olds who need this shit in their life. And you know, every anime fan was there and has been there. That was proven with the passing of Akira Toriyama, and like the entire industry just stopped and was like, oh fuck, our childhood died a little, we need to like all pause and like have a moment here. But, and I think this might have something to do with the like fandom cycles. I'm not, this is fully, I am old Taku out on my porch screaming at the clouds saying, so just take it with a giant grain of salt. But anime fans generally, especially in America, and I can prove this, I ran panels for long enough to see it, are really hardcore into it, usually, for about 2 years. That's not everyone, but that is a majority of anime fans are like really big fans of stuff for 2 years. And then they kind of drift away. And it's not really a drifting, it's more they like that the dedication kind of softens a little. It's not as hard edge, it's not as visceral. It's by 2 years in, you've seen enough where you're like, oh, this show's like this other show, and this show's like this other show, and blah, 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 blah. So I follow these news accounts, these anime news accounts on, I'm not even going to bother mentioning them because they don't really deserve mentioning, if I'm honest, on Instagram. And one of them posted actually on Threads, not Instagram, this story about JJK fan being upset that JJK is boring, that JJK is like all is like derivative, had become like, I'm like, and my whole thing, my whole brain was like, because it, that's the deal. That's the way it goes. Like, you're, have you forgot you're watching a Shonen Jump property? The formula is real, baby. Like, even something like Chainsaw Man gets its formula by screwing with the formula. Like, it's not super complicated. But even there, in that moment, you see this, like, backlash to a super hype, violently popular thing. And I think when Dungeon Meshi is all over and after it's been off for a while, people will go back to it and they'll be like, that was kind of phenomenal. And people will wonder, like, why wasn't I watching that? Because people were still looking for that, like, hype thing, and they hadn't gotten to the point where they were like, hey, no, like, we don't have to chase, like, chasing that high becomes impossible after a while. And that's really the thing I love about Delicious in Dungeon, is that it feels correctly gauged. It doesn't feel like it's so up its own ass that it's, like, intolerable. Like, which I regularly, when I'm watching Solo Leveling, like, sometimes I'll just turn it off halfway through the episode. I'm like, I gotta take a break. This is too much. This is too edgelordy, power fantasy, shitty. I can't. Like, and Solo Leveling seems to be doing something slightly different there that makes it a little bit more interesting and, like, watchable. But, like, I would much rather watch something like between the two, and I've done this many times, I would shoot Dungeon Meshi. I would just be like, no, I'll watch Delicious in the Dungeon. I'll watch Solo Leveling later. Because Delicious in the Dungeon is just the more fun time. It's the, and that's probably why people responded to the manga and why I'm responding to the anime so hard. It's so much more creative. It's so much more fun. It's more interesting. Its emotional hooks are so much more grounded than the like emotional hooks of something like Solo Leveling. And I'm using Solo Leveling specifically because it, to me, Solo Leveling is this show that's proving out the fact that the traditional shonen action formula of promoting a show and of shows existing is kind of stagnating. You started to see it with Jujutsu Kaisen this season. But the thing about Jujutsu Kaisen is, like, the core story is so much more, was so much more involved and so much more interesting, where it wasn't a great test of it. You need something that approached Dirt Stupid. And, like, that approached Dirt Stupid, but had all the pieces to, like, be a, like, to be a mega hit otherwise. And that's what Solo, like, you look at Solo Leveling, by the numbers, it makes total fucking sense that it would be ultra famous. It's a really well-loved Korean webcomic. It's basically wall-to-wall. It's built on a kind of, like, constant action scene, an episode or a chapter kind of thing. So you've got the, like, super overhyped fights. And it just doesn't, like, the show just, it's not doing it for me. And but that's not because of, and that's because specifically of the like overhyped action. That show has this lack of quiet, had this lack of calm to it, that like is unseating, is unsettling. And I talked about Frieren the week before last. You can go check that out in the podcast feed of whatever app you're using to listen to me right now. But Dungeon Meshi has that same quiet, calm, relaxing vibe, but it can also, in the same way that Frieren can, it can ramp it all the way up to 11 as soon as it needs to. I think, and I know this is like action movies versus dramas versus whatever, but I think a lot of fans are going to see the Transformers movies of anime. They're like lining up around the block for that stuff. But like, the most interesting stuff happening in anime right now is, I think, kind of directly on the other side, it's stuff that, like, how should I put this? I think that the creative world of anime and manga has gotten kind of not bored with the storylines of shonen manga, but bored with the trappings. Because if you look at Dungeon Meshi and at Frieren, they are both takes on the fantasy genre that use the same like functions as the fantasy genre always have, and very much live in the like Dungeons and Dragons world of that genre. But they're doing something completely out of left field with it. Like, the point of Frieren is, like, Frieren no longer has to, like, it's, what do you do after you beat the Demon King? It's, how do you feed yourself in a dungeon when the food is too heavy to take down with you? And those peering questions, the more they don't happen in other genres of anime, the less room there is for a fan to grow with that stuff. A thing I've always said about Naruto is Naruto's blessing and his curse is the amount of time it had to be on. And I always use this example, but it's just the easiest example. You know how the mail gets delivered in Naruto. That's bizarre. You don't know who trains the crows that talk to people in Demon Slayer. You just don't know that. And like, I've seen that manga. You never find the fuck out. They're not interested in telling you. And that's because like that doesn't, like, the people writing those stories fully know people don't care. They probably have notes on it. They probably have a character drawn who's like, this is the dude who trains the crows. And I could fully be wrong on that score. They could have introduced that character in like a throwaway thing or a whole chapter. Who knows? But the kind of masterclass version of that is something like Hunter x Hunter. Would they answer those questions? And they like fully answer those questions. And if those questions aren't answered, they have a movie that answers it that's not canon, but who cares? It's an answer. But what if you didn't have to concern yourself with, what if like you were in the world of, say, Demon Slayer? What does it look like to not be a Demon Slayer in Demon Slayer's world? What does it look like not even to be a demon? To be just a geisha in the, to be just a shamisen player in the pleasure district. In, like, at the time when all that shit happened. Like, to be on the edge. To be on the edge of the destruction, like, zone. Of the like, disaster zone. To, like, not know somebody who died, but know somebody who does know somebody who died. Like, what did that look like? To lots of older anime fans, that's really interesting. And that's really what these shows are getting at. They're, like, they're still focused on the main characters of the, like, universe, of their own universe. It's not like you're focused on, like, someone to the left. But they're not focused on the main... They're not so focused on the main objectives. The main objective is usually getting done. The main objective is fully getting done. But they find ways to focus on other things so they can give you more story and give you more to latch on to. And if you look at something like... If you look at Dungeon Meshi, that's what it does. It takes a really sad, deeply fucked up story of a brother and sister who went to, who a brother and sister and friend who hired two other people, who hired I think like three other people or four other people to go down to the dungeon with them. And then they all came out of the dungeon. The sister had been eaten by a dragon. They were forced to retreat. And then the other, like, three, like, other, like, basically all but one of the people who they, like, enlisted, who the two people left, Marcel and Laios, enlisted, just said, we got our money. Sorry, your friend died. And you meet Namari of, like, I think she's like a half ogre who is straight up a mercenary. Like, she was paid to do a job. She technically did it. She got her money. She left. That's fucking dark. To take that story, to take the story of a brother and a, like, family friend going to get that brother's sister back. Or at the very least, her body back. And soften it so much. That's an impressive feat. But also make it not so goofy that it doesn't hold. It's an impressive thing to pull off. It takes real finesse and story ability to do that. And The kind of cognitive swings Trigger is capable of is, I think, what makes that happen. Is, I think, what makes that possible. Because you've seen shows where Trigger doesn't have so much, has tons of control, but it's been diluted a little. And you've seen that in the form of Darling in the Franxx. That show works like a really traditional anime, but it's done partially by Trigger and partially by I think it's A1 Pictures, and it's bizarre. It's weird. It doesn't quite fit. It doesn't go hard enough almost, so it ends up in a weird place. But it also has fucking incredibly phenomenal character design. So, like, the art style of Darling in the Franxx just, like, does wonders for that show's reputation, honestly. But I guess my whole point here is, if you've been curious about Dungeon Meshi, absolutely go watch it. It's the first 12 episodes are on Netflix, probably the first 13 by the time you hear this, and it's got a 24 episode run, so it's gonna be on for a while. But actually, here's why I want to bring this up. The last thing that I think is really interesting is they're at the halfway point, and they have rescued Laios' sister. Like, Fallon is alive again. And now they're just gonna keep doing the show. And that's how, that's like how you know that the show is committed to its bit, is like the main storyline that you are following, it now no longer matters. And here's what I want to bring up. I want to bring up a show and a property, but it had the show, but the easiest thing to do is read the manga for this, called Oceanbow. So, I've talked about Oceanbow on this very podcast. You can go find it in the feed. But Oceanbow had a background story, had a background narrative. But if you read, but even if you read it in order, the background narrative doesn't super matter. It doesn't super matter. And when Oceanbow was originally brought over, because it was brought over really early. It was being published in English, fully in English, when I was in middle school. And they brought it over, and what they did is they chopped up the story and they reorganized it based on food grouping. So, like, there would be one big omnibus that would be about vegetables. There would be one big omnibus that would just be about meat. There would be one big omnibus that was just about fucking alcohol. And by doing that, they basically destroyed the background story. So much so that, like, the male and female main characters go from being, like, married for a year to being absolute strangers to being best friends to being engaged, like, at fucking all over the place. It's hilarious. But the reason why it still works, why it's still readable, is because that was the backing story. The main story is always the food and the, like, educational aspect of this food manga. This kind of reminds me of that. Like, the point of the text of the thing is to be a fun romp through a dungeon where you're cooking and eating monsters. The storyline, doesn't have to be the reason you're watching a show, is, or was until episode 12, rescuing the main character's sister. Now that we've hit that, now that we've accomplished that, who knows where they're going? And they've placed building blocks for other story things to happen. But, like, they're gonna be cooking and eating something once an episode. It's still gonna be great. It's gonna be so much fun. And I just wanted to talk about it because I really enjoyed watching it. And yeah. So on that note, my name is Alex. This has been Lunchbox Radio. If you like the show, definitely share it with a friend. Leave a 5-star rating over on iTunes. It really helps the show. And actually, you know, leave a 5-star rating over on iTunes and let me know what your favorite Delicious and Dungeon dish is if you've seen the show. But until next time, that's all I've got for you, and I will talk to you next Thursday.